Con with the Rule of Three. Tim Slagle over here, over on the other side. My partner in technology,
yes.
Brian Miller.
Hello. And well, yeah, brought to you by technology in so many ways.
I just had a friend that's been listening to our podcast, and she said that she's been considering it. She said, "How do you do it?" And she listened to enough to recognize that you and I are not in the same room, but we sound like we are. And so she said, How do you do it? And I don't know if I'm going to share that with a general audience. If you're close enough to call me, I can tell you how the miracle is performed through technology.
Yeah, I told our pal Kostaki Economopoulos about it this week. He was talking about the podcast, this one, and then I do a sports podcast with some other guys. And he said, "How do you guys do that?" And I explained. I told him how you figured out how we did it. And he said, "That is ingenious." He sort of shook his head and was like, "Slagle."
Well, I'm flattered. Yeah. But this week's episode is dedicated to technology because I realized that all three stories that we picked have a tech angle.
Yeah, we backed into a theme.
It's the first of which it came out of the news. I don't know if you saw this because
Facebook certainly didn't run it.
yeah, and I imagine that NPR did not talk about it. It's kind of on my end. It's a big news story.
Oh, it was all over the regular media.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I know. I definitely saw it on CNN and HuffPost, actually.
Okay. No, that's fine. Did not know.
Yeah.
An ex-Facebook employee, or maybe it might have been a handful of them, admitted that Facebook censors conservative news. And which is strange to me because I still get a lot of it.
Well, now I'll say this. That's the headline. The actual version is what the guy said was, well, he said there was kind of bias in all directions because he said there were people whose job it was to comb through the trending topics. And so he said, oh, yeah. So he said, you could tell who was working when certain stories were trending. You know, like if somebody was really into a band, that band would trend more often. For real. I mean, so it wasn't like there was a company mandate or anything like that. But what the guy said was, yeah, it depended on who was working the boards. And he says, and then they asked him, well, do you think there was a liberal bias? And he said, like, well, there were probably, yeah. He's like, yeah, there was probably more liberals than conservatives. So yeah, it probably slanted that way. So that I don't know. The scary headline is a little less scary, but also a fine example of how you never know how your news is being pre-chewed for you.
Well, you know, that's kind of interesting because normally when the you know, like the New York Times and you know the Washington Post, when they go through the stories and see which stories are relevant and which mm-hmm. ones are not, mm-hmm. they usually have a background in journalism. They probably got nowadays, you know, wasn't so in the beginning, but nowadays you got to have a degree in journalism and then you have to work yourself way up through the ranks to actually become an editor.
Yes, exactly. You had to kind of prove your chops.
So you have a news background. With Facebook, you know, these are people who could do code marathons and keep up with Zuckerberg.
So. Right, absolutely. So they're just excited, you know, about the new Run the Jewels album or who's playing at Coachella or something. And it's like, yeah, that's not that important. You know, oh, Justin Bieber's got a face tattoo.
Yeah, that's definitely a trending topic. And, you know. Meanwhile, a House Appropriations bill hits the floor of the Senate, and it's like, just dial tone.
And of course, the greater reality is, if you're getting your news from Facebook, woe is us, and I know a lot of people do. I'll put it this way, the only worse place to get news from than the people moderating the Facebook trending topics is your Facebook friends. Your Facebook friends, whoever they are, inevitably have the worst taste in politics and movies.
Yeah. If you're getting your news from memes, you're in trouble.
Or I have a friend. I love him. He's a great guy, but he is physically psychologically and emotionally incapable of discerning between a plausible news source and just like something somebody wrote on a handbill and stapled to a telephone pole. Like, there's really no difference between it. And so he'll post – but the funny thing is it mostly manifests itself in terms of, like, he'll post something about, like, oh, man, that new Marvel movie we were looking forward to isn't going to happen because of this and blah, blah, blah. It'll be some entertainment thing. And I look at it and I go, well, that's not true. I mean, I would have heard about this in reputable news sources. And it's – where's this website? You know, billyssite.com or something, you know? And he'll be like, no, it's true, man. I read it. So it's like he just – he can never do that. And so when he does post political stuff, I always keep in mind, well, you never know where this is coming from.
Well, here's the interesting thing that I've noticed is that when old people first figured out email – if you had like an uncle or a grandparent, you would get all these emails of just conspiracy nonsense.
Yes, absolutely.
And incorrect and stuff that had been forwarded so many times that it would just be one long vertical line down with one letter per line.
It was like the new golden age of urban legends, almost.
Yeah.
People got native style superstitious about that crap.
Yeah, and well, that's when Snopes came up through the ranks, but
not Native American, by the way. I want to clarify. I meant that in a metaphorical sense.
But what was interesting is that now, and I don't know if it's just because we're all aging that now we're getting into that category where we're susceptible to that, or if it's actually young people that are falling for the same crap. I think there should be a moratorium on Onion spinoffs.
Yes, because the ones that you especially sometimes can get inadvertently confused and or lured in by is when they're poorly done. So it's like, well, it's not that funny. Like the Onion is an Onion article because it makes you laugh really hard when you see it.
Right.
But an unfunny parody often just comes off like a headline, like a badly written headline.
Yeah, and then it gets well, some of them do it on purpose. I mean, they get websites like CBSnews.co, mm-hmm. I think is one. So I mean, they're purposely trying to trick people just because I don't know why.
always the thing. Like I've talked to my wife and I both say this is one of our pet peeves is people who don't understand what a joke or a prank is, and they'll say something. You know, they're like, "Oh man, I'm just pretty bummed out because my mom, she's real sick lately." And you're like, "Oh, that's terrible. How are you doing?" You go, "Oh, I'm just kidding. My mom's fine." And you're like, "Well, you just lied. That's all that was.
Oh, man, it was so cool. I loosened the lug nuts on my buddy's car. And when he went off the cliff, oh, you should have seen his face."
Yeah, that's the acid base extreme, the opposite ends of the spectrum of prank guy. The guy who overdoes something and the guy who did nothing and thinks it's funny. But yeah, just like, yeah, it's not funny if you just lie. Like, I got people to believe stuff. Well, congratulations. You know, you congratulations on being the seventh billionth successful liar in the history of humankind.
It's, I think, now that I think about it, I think the everyone thinks that when you see something like that, they're ripping off the Onion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in some respects, the Onion kind of ripped off the Weekly World News.
I would say the Onion evolved that, but it, I think I would bet you those guys would say that they were the Onion. By the way, invented in Wisconsin,
yeah,
University of Wisconsin, not too far from here. My wife went to high school with some of the original Onion guys.
Wow!
Talk about a thing those guys never. And we're just off topic. Those guys never could have anticipated that gag paper becoming so big that it kind of like the Daily Show became a weird. The Daily Show didn't give people their news, but I think the Daily Show definitely influenced how people thought about their news, you know, in a way that made it kind of like news. And I think the Onion has done the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, people will cite a really clever Onion headline almost as though it's a legit point.
Well, yeah, and sometimes when there's a legit point that sounds not the Onion – is actually is a catchphrase now.
Yeah, exactly. So it's The question is, will Facebook let us see The Onion?
And the question is, what's the next topic? Because this one's over.
Yeah. Through the magic of technology, we'll be back for the second segment.
Face me. Need you to face me. Don't have to turn away to seal it. I'm the man you want to be with.
And we're back on segment two of The Rule of Three. Tim Slagle, Brian Miller. And what hit me in the news, and I guess this is sort of a pop culture topic more than a news topic, was that Elon Musk tested the prototype of the Hyperloop.
Oh, he tested. I did. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was actually tested, and I've actually read a couple articles that conflict on the specs of the test, and that's that for me. That was the important. That was the thing that I found curious. Now it wasn't. If you know anything about the Hyperloop, the original idea was that it was going to be a drive-through bank tube that ran from that ran from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and it was supposed to get you make that trip in like a half hour. And it's one of those ideas that's great on paper. The idea is you don't have to, you know, take a jet to altitude just to bring it back down. You don't have to go through. Well, I don't know why you think you wouldn't have to go through TSA, because if those mail tubes are as packed as airplanes, they certainly could become terrorist targets. If they're flying over populated areas, absolutely they could become terrorist targets. But
anything could be a terrorist. I mean, a shopping mall, movie theater. You know?
Not Amtrak. I mean, Amtrak brags about the fact that you can just walk right on the train. That you know that there's no TSA screening.
I boarded. I had already purchased a train ticket to go visit my girlfriend. On like the train ticket was for like 9:15 or 9:14. What are you? A couple days after 9/11, and I remember showing up to the. Amtrak station, all set to go, thinking I was going to be like, you know, probed and swabbed and point, you know, all this. And they were just like, oh, can I help you back here? Oh, it sounds like this grandfather clock's real ticking pretty good. Just throw it in. A friend of mine, actually, this is even funnier, took an Amtrak train like 2 weeks after 9/11. And this friend of mine is a bit of a kinkster, to say the least. And with him and his traveling companion was a homemade sex robot that he had made himself because he's a tech geek that fit in a suitcase. And so he had a suitcase full of like vibrating, moving mechanical parts and pistons and stuff, and didn't think about it until he was handing his bag to the porter and they just threw that damn thing right on there.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to guess if I know your friend or not.
You don't. It's not somebody you know.
I don't know if it's somebody I'd like to know.
Depends on how bad you need a sex robot.
Yeah, I guess so. No, but you see, here's the thing. In order, you know, for a terrorist action to really get the attention, you have to kill hundreds of people, and you know that means you got to hit about 12 Amtrak trains. So that's the idea, is the Hyperloop. You're just going to go zip from Los Angeles to San Francisco. And everyone's kind of saying, nah, that's really not going to work. So Elon Musk went out to the Las Vegas desert, and he set up a track, and he put a metal sled on it, and he got a bunch of people to sit in bleachers and watch the metal sled go along the track.
Isn't like a Hot Wheel or one of those little snap-in racetracks you used to put in your
Yeah, it kind of – and you can search for the video, and it kind of just looks like a drag race. It looks like that's all it looks like. And it doesn't go very far, and then it crashes into a pile of sand because they haven't developed the brakes yet. So it would seem that the Hyperloop is way behind schedule, is that they're having some technological hurdles that they've been unable to scale. The thing, the sled, it's not, there's no passenger vehicle, there's no tube, there's no pneumatics, there's nothing. It's not elevated, it's just something that went really fast along a track and smacked into a pile of sand. And you know, people are like, oh, it's possible, it's feasible. It's no, what were you watching? You know, it kind of looked like a plane launch off of a aircraft carrier is all it kind of looked like. And two different articles I read, one said that it went up to 120 miles an hour in a second. Wow. Another one said that it went up to 400 miles an hour in 2 seconds. Now I'm a geek, okay?
Uh-huh.
I happen to know that if you can go from 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds, you will experience the force of 1G.
So you're going to have basically a bunch of people in like a NASA test, like astronaut training.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, 400 miles an hour in 2 seconds? That's like 6 Gs.
Yeah, so wouldn't that break your neck?
Yeah, well, that rips your heart off the aorta. That's like the kind of G's that, you know, you got to have pressure suits and training to experience if you can even survive that. I think 7 Gs is death.
And Chuck Yeager and the Limits of the Envelope and whatnot. I've read my Tom Wolfe.
So it went really, really fast, but there's a limit, you know. we'll get people. The first Hyperloop, they opened the first Hyperloop car and just, ooh, yuck.
Yeah, everyone just kind of oozes out.
Maybe we got to slow it down a little bit.
So is the idea, if like, let's say that he got this working, is the idea that at some point the whole country would have an interconnected series of hyper loops that would connect all the various cities, so you could go travel? Would that be the idea? Or
I think it's his vision of the future. But I think what it is, it's for the highly trafficked short routes.
Right.
Chicago to Detroit, San Francisco to L.A., Las Vegas to L.A. You know, these really quick routes that there's really no sense to get in a plane, and it's just a little too far for people to drive. Yeah. And then of course it would also relieve air traffic, because then you could just have major hubs. So rather than flying from Detroit to LA, you would take the Hyperloop to Chicago and then fly from Chicago to LA.
Yeah, I mean, I will say in Elon's defense, and this does sound, The really great inventors and the big idea guys, the nature of chasing the big ideas is you always wind up chasing an idea that's too big, right? Don't all these guys end up with some project that, like, but his real vision, you know,
yeah,
was a car that turned into a house that babysat your kids? And you're like, whoa. But, you know, it's like, or even like, you know, Howard Hughes starts off making Hell's Angels and these like incredible giant blockbuster movies, but eventually he's like, I'll make an even bigger movie. And of course, you know,
a huge plane. Like, no, Howard, you invented a diamond bit oil rig drill.
Yes,
that's all you ever really did, and congratulations on that. However,
we made Hell's Angels, one of the first blockbusters.
That was
a very revolutionary movie of its time.
But is Elon Musk, that's PayPal, that's the PayPal guy, right?
And the Tesla guy.
Yeah, well, I'm not sold on Tesla yet.
Man, those things look sharp, and everybody I know who's got one loves it.
Uh-huh. Everyone that's got one that hasn't burned the garage down yet.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, I don't know. I think that is going to turn out to be his legacy, as those Tesla cars. That's my guess. But also, the other thing is that, you know, much like comedy, a lot of ideas evolve asymmetrically. And so the positive thing about having a guy like Elon Musk cooking up some bizarre ideas is you never know what thing he might invent in his pursuit of his invention, or what inspiration/tangential benefits this will have to other people looking at those same ideas. So things don't always, you know, you don't. We got Tang because we tried to go to the moon. We didn't get Tang because we tried to get Tang.
Well, yeah, I'm sure you go to the moon, you get a lot of Tang.
Speaking of Chuck Yeager. Well, that's definitely as good a spot as any to leave off segment two. Back on the final segment of Rule of Three, a little bit of vagary. There's a little mystery. If somebody knows the answer to this, you can send a message. But I was thinking about technology, and I was thinking about an invention, a fellow back, I believe, in the 80s. And I can't remember his name, and I can't find it on the internet, because the limits of the internet is things that happened before 1996.
Yeah. Yeah, once people started getting DSL into their house, That was it. That was when history began.
Yeah, but it's going to be the sedimentary layer of history. People are like, what? We have no idea what happened. Hill Street Blues, what was that?
Yeah, a few newspapers went through the trouble to transcribe their previous editions into a format that could be posted on the internet. But it's funny when you search an article before that 1996 timeline, how slim that article is. No pictures, just kind of a, you know, text document. It's there really
scan,
was
maybe just text scan, you know, just, you know, dumped into a Word file.
So if it's a small news item like the one you were looking for, forget it. It's not there.
And it's in a book that I have that is packed up in a box of many other books waiting to be moved to its new home. But there was a fella who invented a machine back when comedy was big money, back during the boom. And his whole pitch was he was going to invent a machine that measures the laughs per minute and then calculates how funny a comedian is. So club owners no longer have to go to the trouble of using subjective means to determine who they want to book. You just record all these comedians and you just see what their laugh score is. And then you can have your own machine in every club, right? And boy, you know, I know you said you were a 46.2 kind of guy, but according to this measure, you've only been doing 39s all week or whatever.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I know a lot of club owners book like that.
They do to some degree, kind of by ear.
Yeah,
I mean, it calls into question I don't think the problem was that the device didn't work. Technically, you know, it did, you know, measure decibel level and duration and all this.
Yeah, but you know, what if you were getting booze per minute? Could the machine? I don't think that in the 80s that technology was so sophisticated that it could differentiate between a boo and a laugh.
I don't know about that, and again, I don't have that stupid book handy.
Unless a laugh has a different pitch than a boo.
Right. Well, but the other thing is, it certainly doesn't differentiate between kinds of laughs. And we all know the difference between like a, kind of laugh versus like when you catch somebody off guard with a really good idea, you know.
Yeah.
So it does call into mind the whole system of how to judge a comic. Because like you said, we can also say like, well, thank goodness that machine didn't proliferate. But, I mean, that's still a measurement. And it's still a measurement comics, whether they want to admit it or not, use for themselves if they're good comics a lot of times.
Well, when you're putting together a showcase set, I've often done that. I have actually, you know, timed how many punchlines I'm hitting in a minute, because in a showcase there does seem to be some validity to that when you're doing a short set. You know, when they only give you 6 minutes, you want to try to get like about 40 laughs in that 6 minutes. So you know it. Mechanically, I use it to trim the words. Maybe I can get another line in there if I trim one word off of each joke.
Right, and it's a particular thing if you're making if you're going to like a festival and doing a competition set, or you know if you're taping a TV set. And it's interesting too. There's also you can because then a lot of alt comedy, as the, if you want to call it that or whatever. A lot of the really great comics, you know, came out in the 90s and the Largo type guys, like Dana Gould. You know, Dana definitely plays the silences. And I think the laughs per minute is kind of an unhip way to view comedy now, in a way. You know, I mean, it's both valid and not, because you get a guy like Kyle Kinane who will have really long stretches of silence, but then when he starts hitting, you know, it's just punchline, 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 or, you know, he's just working in a different rhythm. Or Tig Notaro works in a completely different rhythm.
Right. It's, you know, an interesting act could actually, do, like if it's just, if you're a storyteller, do long, you know, minute-long pieces with absolutely no, you know, no noise, and then, you know, and then the payoff is so great that no one cares that they just sat there without laughing for you know, a minute or two. So it's, yeah, absolutely, it is a horrible measure, but if
but
you're
also not, right,
if you're a club, if you're a club that just cares about the amount of whiskey you sell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what you want. You want, you know, oh my God, it was so fun, I couldn't stop laughing all night. It's like, ooh, that was a good act.
Right. And it is, I mean, at the same time, it's interesting because I'm certainly, my favorite comics are, for the most part, the people who had those idiosyncratic rhythms, particularly Dana Gould is just my favorite. And, you know, he's also got times where he's just bombarding you with punchlines. So, you know, it's not like he's intentionally defying the craft, but, you know, it's a blunt instrument to measure, but we all do use that as a quick measurement sometimes. Like, I got a lot of laughs. They were, you know, and that's the interesting thing about comedy is, you know, as subjective as laughter is, objectively, laughter is the only goal.
Well, I do know that there are bookers. I do know that there are bookers that hate comedy.
Yes,
that you know, and it sounds weird. That, well, why would you be in comedy? Well, they saw a great way to make money. You know, is people who are in oil don't necessarily love the smell of oil.
Well, yeah, and you know, that was my biggest disappointment with going out to California the first time and getting to hang out. You know, And there's plenty of people who are really great and really into it. But so many of the people who are in the business don't really care about movies. They just know that this is a way to potentially make a lot of money. Like, yeah. It stunned me how few movies – I feel like no one in L.A. had ever seen a movie. Every time I brought a movie up, everyone was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, the Oscar winner from 2005?
Huh. How much did it bring in?
yeah, right. What were the dailies?
I don't remember. It must have had some pretty weak box office. Yeah, those Oscar films usually do.
Yeah, you're right, Booker. There are truly bookers who hate comedy.
And they can't watch it. They can't stand watching comedy. So what they do is they sit in the office with the door closed, playing Tetris on their computer, and they just listen to the noise that's coming through the door. And to them, the good comics are the ones that, you know, that rattle the door.
Yeah, and if you're just doing stock crowd lines or really generic jokes that 100 other people have some version of, it's completely irrelevant.
Or as I like to call it, comedy in the 80s.
How easy must that have been when you could just do a version of something everybody else is doing and it's considered good enough?
Well, somebody pointed out to me that what the 80s created was cover comedy. And it was the cover band and the comedy that was going on at that time was almost identical. Is you would go to the Holiday Inn Lounge somewhere in small town America, and you would see somebody doing songs that you know, but it's not the original person doing the songs. And that's exactly what comedy was. It was in the Holiday Inn lounges all in small towns of America, and comics doing jokes that you've heard, but not the person you originally heard them from.
Yeah, bro. So yeah, so it is interesting that there's something about comedy that is immeasurable. I think there's something about any good art that is immeasurable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
That's
there's
the magic.
I don't think you can teach it. I don't think you can rate it. I don't think, you know, I've always said, and that's why I've always hated comedy contests. It's like putting Norman Rockwell up against Picasso. You know, Norman Rockwell's always going to win.
Yeah. Or even, you know, putting, you could be putting Picasso against Degas against Roy Lichtenstein. It's like, well, what if they're all doing really interesting, totally different things? You know, you're going to tell me that, like, Andy Erickson and Robert Burrill and Cy Amundsen are you're going to judge which one's better, per se? Like, I mean, they're all doing such totally different things.
No, but, no, they're all, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, they're all doing.
I just wanted to see which one of them listens to the podcast.
Right. There's a real litmus test.
I'll get an email. Well, who do you think?
Maybe we'll tell you on the next episode of Rule of Three. It'll be a cliffhanger. But I believe that brings us to the end of the technology segment. We shouldn't push the technology any further.
Okay. TimSlegel.com, where all the episodes are.
Yep. And Real Brian Miller at Twitter, BrianMillerComedy.com, where you can get the current episode.
Is it still Brian with a Y, or did you do that?
Oh, I've got to do that. Yes. Yes. But
speaking of tech.
Yes. Speaking of tech, I got to make a note of that. That's on my list of things to do.
See you next week.
See you next week.